and welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Dave Waldron, and today we're talking sake. Starting tonight and throughout this week, the Anchorage business La Bodega is hosting Sake Week. The event is a celebration that will take place mostly in Anchorage, but a few places in Girdwood as well, consisting of sake flights, pairings, and some educational opportunities for those that would like to learn more about the drink. And speaking of education, for the first part of our show, we're going to give you sort of a sake 101. And for that, we have two guests in the studio. Pamela Hatzis is the owner of La Bodega, and Skylar Pei, who works there as their official sake coordinator. Welcome to you both.
Hello.
Hello, thank you.
Well, let's start really basic. I've heard it pronounced sake and sake. Is there a right way to say it, and which one is it? We'll start with you, Pamela.
Yeah, the way that it was described to me, you don't say merlot, you say it merlot, even though it has a T. And it's the same with sake. We say sake. It's the Japanese pronunciation.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Got it.
But we won't look down on you if you do it wrong.
That's good. I'll definitely say it wrong at some point. I probably should ask that question before I did the intro, but that's, you know, I think I got it right.
You nailed it.
All right. Well, Pamela, tell us about Sake Week. This is your fifth annual celebration, though I think it probably would have been your eighth if we hadn't had COVID. How did Sake Week come together?
Actually, I think the numbers are like more than that even. We did the first one in 2014, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19. And then we took some years off, during which we did some virtual things. Yeah, but so we're really excited that this year, 2023, we're bringing the whole week back. So we have five total events. And so it's two dinners, two flight nights, and it culminates in our big expo, which is at O'Malley on the Green, which is a big, huge tasting event modeled after what we get to do in the industry, where we enter a room that is filled with tables of sake and we get to taste. And if you were in the industry, you would decide what you were going to purchase. But in this case, you just get to decide what you enjoy and what you're interested in. It's really fun.
And where did the idea come from to do this? I mean, I've seen Sake Week elsewhere, like, and it is kind of around this time of year. So are there places celebrating it?
Yeah, I think it happens in spring because of the cherry blossoms and all the things. And there are certain sake styles that we don't get consistently every year here, but where really fresh sake comes out this time of year. And so it's a good time for a celebration.
Do you think it's getting more popular as a drink? I mean, I've been to your store over the years, and it definitely seems like there's like a sake section that gets a little bigger every year.
It objectively is getting more popular, yes. Mm-hmm. The reason that I started Sake Week back in the day is because I just felt like we need to get everyone immersed in this, because everything else is so prolific. We see beer everywhere. We see wine everywhere. Spirits are everywhere, but sake is not everywhere. And it's not a thing where you can try it one time, one sake, and decide if you quote unquote like it. So I felt that it was really important to expose people and teach them. And so we do for a whole week, because why not? And that was the idea.
Well, let's do some teaching. Skylar, you're a sake expert, it sounds like.
I don't know about an expert.
Well, I'm going to treat you like one. What is sake for our listeners, and how's it made? What are the basics?
So sake is rice, koji yeast, water, and added alcohol. And sometimes it doesn't have the added alcohol to it, which is a Junmai style.
You said koji yeast?
Koji yeast, oh. Yes.
How is that different from a beer yeast?
Koji yeast is the same yeast that they use on soybeans to create soy sauce or even miso paste. So it's very popular in Japan.
There's lots of different types of wine. And of course, those different types of wine come from different kinds of grapes. And there's a lot of different grape varieties out there. How many different types of rice are there out there? And does that dictate the sake type?
It doesn't dictate the sake type, per se. It definitely has different flavor profiles to it. I don't know how many rice flavor or rice types there are, to be completely honest. I know there's, I think, 15 koji types.
There are lots and lots of rice types, and the koji is a mold that you add to the rice that creates, and then it becomes koji rice.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you for correcting me on that.
There's many, many types of rice, but there's like just a few that are mostly used.
Does that scare people sometimes when they hear mold?
When they hear mold?
Yeah.
No, I don't feel like it does.
Bring it on.
I think it makes people interested. Yeah, to backpedal a little bit about also why I was interested in it is because every time that I ever brought sake to any kind of event or party or gathering, it was so well received.
And there's lots of different styles of it, right? I mean, there's a lot. So like compared to wine, let's say, like how vast is the sake world?
Should we break it down?
Yeah, let's break it down.
Okay, go for it.
A lot of the styles are based on the rice polish or semi-buai. Did I pronounce that right, Pamela?
Semi-buai.
Semi-buai. Okay, perfect. So it starts out with Junmai, where there's not really a limit to the rice polish ratio. And then we got Hanjozo, which is a minimum of 70% to the rice polish, which is where they just roll the rice to the point where there's 30% less of what's on the grain itself. It's a little bit harder to describe than it is. I much prefer to show it.
Well, let's explain how it breaks down into like the two sides, because it's really compared to wine, I find it much more simple. It really breaks down into the two, like if it were two rectangles side by side. One side has the four ingredients, rice, koji, water, and yeast. And then the other side, you have that additional brewer's alcohol you can add. And then as you go up and down in the triangle, you're just polishing the rice more. And that's it.
The rice being polished, what does that do as it gets more and more polished? What does it do to the sake?
You're getting closer and closer. As you polish it, you're polishing more and more of the fats and starches. And you're getting closer to the kernel, like where the nectar is, so to speak. I've heard people say that. So it changes the flavor profile, and then it becomes more and more, this word gets overused, but it's more elegant, it's more pointed, more like sharper flavors, crisper.
It's a lot cleaner, too.
Cleaner finish, yeah, cleaner on the mouthfeel. Mm-hmm.
What are some of the misconceptions about sake? Because I feel like there's probably a lot of them. I know for years I thought all sake was supposed to be drank warm. And that's just because I would order it at a sushi restaurant and it would be served warm. But now I know that there's a lot of sake that's supposed to be served cold. So working at a place that sells sake, what are some of those misconceptions you hear about it?
I think that is one of the biggest misconceptions, is that it's supposed to be drank warm. And actually, most of the sakes that we have at the shop now are meant to be drank cold or at least room temperature. You get a lot more flavor coming out of it when it's chilled or even if it's at room temperature. Of course, there's definitely sake on the shelf that we have that's, if you heat it up a lot more, you do get more flavor out of it than some others, mainly Hanjozo and the Junmai types. But for the most part, it would be drink chilled.
Yeah, but don't be intimidated. Although I agree with Skylar, yeah, most of our sake presents itself cold, maybe the best, quote unquote. But if you like it warm, warm it up. You bought it. Yeah. And it's going to taste great still, just not the same.
This could be another misconception as well, but I was told that if it's cheap, you should warm it up. And it kind of masks the harshness. And if it's like a nicer sake, you should serve it cold so you can really get everything. Is that true or is that a myth?
I think it's kind of a myth, wouldn't you say?
It's kind of a myth, yeah. I'd agree.
Yeah, I mean, there's some truth to it, is that the lower the polish ratio, it's going to be less expensive. Side note, one of the things that we love about sake is that it's a very honest price. What you pay on for the bottle, it makes sense why you're paying it, because it costs more money to polish more, for example. But really what you like is just what you like. And if you like the sakes that are more robust and that cost less and they're polished less, those can be great for warming up. And they're not harsh. Mm-hmm. I don't find them harsh. I don't think we have a harsh sake.
I don't think we have a harsh sake either. I never really thought of sake as being harsh. It has always been elegant and clean to me. And even if it has those robust flavors or fuller body profile, it's never been like spirit hot.
Yes, exactly. And where the myth comes from is the 70s-ish and from before too. But when U.S. soldiers were going overseas, they were developing a taste, and therefore the production ramped up hardcore. But also these places had rice shortages, so they were supplementing with alcohol. And in that case, that sake is harsh, and then you're going to want to warm it up. And then they came back wanting that. So there was a market for that for a long time.
So what does the temperature do to that flavor? Like, is there, if you take one sake and serve it warm, mm-hmm. And what will that do to the flavor as opposed to serving it chilled? Like, can you get different results?
Yes. I have a friend that owns a sake shop in Honolulu, It's called the Sake Shop, I think. And at her tasting events, she presents all the sake, warm and cold, just because she likes people to decide. But when you warm something up, it takes out the nuance. It just becomes a simpler thing. So you'll lose some aroma. So it will just become like a more simple version of whatever it was. If you think about mulled wine, it's kind of the same. You know, usually we throw fruit and things like that into mulled wine because otherwise just hot red wine is kind of boring.
So what are some of the typical flavor profiles of sake? When you think of wine, or when I think of wine, I think of berries, cherries, grapes, and like it's either kind of sweet or acidic, but with sake, it's got its own world. So describe those flavors.
Right. I definitely say with a Junmai Ginjo or a Ginjo style, I would expect more of like a crisp, like maybe green apple note, maybe some honeydew melon, maybe a little bit of banana in there too. For Hanjozos, I get more of like sometimes bubblegum, sometimes vegetal notes. It really depends with those, and they're a lot of fun just because of that. Same with Fushutsus. They're kind of hard to predict as far as the flavor profile goes, but they're fun and like almost yeasty and a little bit of like sourdough bread, if you will, at least from the ones I've tasted. Of course, taste is different to everybody. Junmai Daiginjos, they do tend to be on the cleaner side, of course, because of the higher rice polish.
The highest.
It's definitely the highest, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, the MAC, they go 50% and below that, so you can get like a really small rice grain. But flavor profile, sorry. Again, you get that really clean note. You don't really get too much flavor profile in it. I did get a lot of floral notes from the last Junmai Daiginjo that I had, but it was so light and so minimal that it was hard to tell that it was even there, and that's what made it so beautiful. Let's see, I'm missing a style.
Yeah, Junmai.
Junmai, right.
Which Junmai, I failed to mention prior, it translates to pure rice. So that's the side of the rectangle that only uses the four ingredients is Junmai.
Without added brewer's alcohol, so.
Yes.
Is that like the sake purist drink?
No.
No.
Okay. Nope. It's strictly a choice by the toji, which is the brewmaster.
Right. I love that that sake makers, or at least some of them, are called brewmasters. Like the wine people are the vintners, the beer people are the brewers, but you have this cool toji mm-hmm. title, and you get to be called a brewmaster. What does it take to become a brewmaster?
To become a toji?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. I know they have to go through a lot of courses, and they have their own college for it, and they have to go through rigorous courses to become a toji.
In Japan.
In Japan, yes.
Yeah, it's hard to do. And it's like, I just read a big article in the Smithsonian Magazine. It's not a new article, but it was about this sake brewer in Arizona who moved to Arizona to start sake brewing there from Japan because it was just less barriers to entry. I mean, it's very a rigid structure in Japan, and you need to be fully committed, and it's like a lifetime apprenticeship. You might never be a toji and brew sake your whole life.
It's kind of like the monks that make the beer in, where is that, Pamela? In Europe somewhere, there's like
in
caves.
Yes, in Europe, mostly Belgium, but in other places too.
Right, yeah. Yes, very exclusive. So Pamela, what are some of the more interesting sakes you sell? I know there's like sparkling sakes. There's ones with like yuzu jelly in there when it has like a boba texture to it. What are some mm-hmm. of the unique ones you sell there at La Bodega?
Gosh. Well, my favorites, like I said, at the moment, I'm kind of on a Hanjozo kick. I love Aiko Fuji Onkara. It has a really beautiful label with no writing on it. It's just a beautiful art, like a watercolor or something like that. It's gorgeous. And yeah, and that one I really, really enjoy. I like it warm. I like it cold. I think it just goes with everything. It's beautiful. We also have a bunch of sake from female tojis, which we have a nice display of right now too in the shop. And man, are they amazing. I mean, if you can imagine what it takes to become a male toji in Japan, to work your way up as a woman, I mean, the sakes, they are amazing. They have to be that much, that good to get to the level they're at.
What was the name you said again? The one that you like a lot right
now? Hanjozo?
Is that the brand?
Or it's
is that
the style.
The style.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's fairly low within those rectangles. But I think it's fun. It has like a lot of nuance and depth, and it's got a lot of character. The best cup of sake, though, is one that someone pours for you.
Amen.
That's always how I've enjoyed it best. I imagine there's some pretty good sake cocktails out there as well.
Yeah, you could sub sake for a lot of vodka cocktails or even gin if it's the right sake, if it has enough spice notes and things like that. Sake Marys are a really easy, wildly popular thing to do. We used to sell them when we had a restaurant for a minute. People loved them.
Sake and a Bloody Mary?
Yeah, is that right? Instead of vodka.
Wow.
And then fun fact, any sake cocktail you make will be a low ABV cocktail, just because sake has a lower ABV than a spirit. So there you go.
So as a general rule, I don't think anyone would say alcohol is healthy for you, but I have heard that sake is one of the more healthy alcohols out there and that there's a bunch of health benefits to drinking it.
Oh my gosh.
Are you aware of these at all?
I don't remember off the top of my head. I've definitely heard the same thing, but I don't remember which ones. Do you know what the best sake health benefits are?
No.
Okay. I'm glad I'm not the only one. I'm like trying to pull it off my head. I'm like, I feel like I've heard this before and I don't remember.
If you're drinking sake, you're thinking about it. So that's a healthy thing to do because you're not just going to, you know what I mean? Does that make sense?
You're doing what you want to do? Like
you're living your
best life?
You're contemplating. You've thought of this.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, you've thought, okay, I'm going to try something different. And so I think it's a thinking person's choice. But it's also just, you know, not to diminish if you're just having fun. But also, sake is a very clean drink. It's clean. There's no drama in a bottle of sake. Honestly, I love wine. I love beer. Sometimes there's things in there. Sometimes there's colors. Sometimes there's, you know, there's tons of sugar. Sometimes in sake, you really are just getting what it says. You're getting rice, you're getting koji kin, you're getting yeast, and you're getting water. And maybe you're getting a little added brewer's alcohol. But because of that, it's just such a simple buzz to me that feels more like a high than a buzz. And if, as my favorite sake mentor, Marcus Pacaser, always says, if you drink nothing but sake all night, you will be fine the next day. If you mix it with absolutely anything, it will be a terrible next day, and it will be the other thing's fault.
I feel like Marcus would say that, yeah.
Yes.
Well, in my extensive, 10 minutes of research I did on the internet, the things that I found were like low acidity, no sulfites, good for your skin, gluten-free, and mentioned it, way less likely to have a hangover. So those were the things that I saw.
All of those things are true.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
I don't know about the skin part,
yeah, right.
But all the rest of it is true. And honestly, that probably has to do with the koji, because they do use sometimes the leftover rice or the koji rice. They'll make cosmetic products with it.
Mm. I will definitely mention that the site that I found most of that information on was a sake brewery. So, you know, take it with a grain.
No,
of,
I mean, I think it's all true. I have no reason to dispute it. It's healthy.
It sounds like that's one of the real draws of it is the simplicity. I know other wine and beer gets really caught up in trends. Like I like to drink IPA, and it's like I feel like every 6 months there's a new trend. It was like juicy IPAs and then hazy IPAs, and now it's like they're just all like milkshake IPAs. Is that one of the draws of sake? Is it just doesn't really fool around with trends? Stays true to itself?
I'd say so, yeah. It's pretty pretty straightforward with what you want to get. And I know with a lot of the toji, they want to create like they want to present themselves in the sake, and they don't necessarily want to follow a trend, if that makes sense.
Yeah, the times that you do see something like that happen, it's really clear. It's like, oh, that's a new flashy package. They're trying, you know. But yeah, for the most part, they're not catering to these types of things.
Let's do a little lightning round situation. I will pretend that I'm a customer walking into your business. I don't know anything about sake, but I want to try it, and I'll kind of just give you like what I normally drink, and then you give me a suggestion. Does that sound okay?
Yeah, that
all
works.
Right. All right. Okay, so I only drink IPAs, and the stronger the better.
I think you're going to really like a genshu. Genshus are undiluted sakes, and they also have a really high ABV. So if you like stronger, with a higher alcohol content, you're definitely going to go with the genshu. It's just going to have like a more rigid mouthfeel, if you will, like not necessarily sandpaper, but maybe like a rye whiskey would. So if you like IPAs and you want stronger the better, then you should try Ginchu first.
Pamela, rosé all day. And I want to try sake now.
I was like, yes, rosé all day.
Of course.
No. Gosh, rosé all day. Sometimes we have a pink sparkling sake that's fabulous. I think that would be lovely. We also have a red rice sakes occasionally, so that could be fun. And I also think you might really enjoy just a classic Junmai, just for the drinkability. Yeah, just nice, clean, not too much to think about, just like nice little sipper.
Let's see, Skylar, I like pilsners on the weekdays and jello shots on the weekends.
Pilsners and jello shots. All right, that's quite a combo, Dave.
Yes, I'm asking for a friend.
So for the pilsner, I think a really good substitute as far as the sake goes would be a ginjo style or junmai ginjo, or even a junmai dai ginjo if you want to be super clean and crisp. Again, you're going to get like those pineapple, like green apple flavors, but for the most part, it's going to be pretty clean. And then let's see, for your jelly, we do have these like little jelly shots, and you got to shake it up more than 20 times. I mean, it says 20 times, but you want to shake it up like 50. It's like your arm's going to hurt. But it's going to have a little bit of sake in there, but it's also going to have like jelly balls in there that are kind of like tapioca, but a little softer. So I think you should have a little fun and like experiment with one of those.
Yeah.
Pamela, I only drink bourbon, but I'm interested in sake now.
Oh, my friend, you have a whole world to explore. Gosh. May I recommend Ozeki Platinum? I picked this one specific sake. Ozeki is a huge company. So what they're able to do is actually make a really good value-priced Junmai Dai Ginjo. It's like $10 or $12 for a little bottle, and it's the highest polished ratio. It's absolutely fabulous. So why don't you start with that, and then we'll take it from there.
All right, I got one more, and this isn't a what I drink suggestion I'm looking for. This is a what I'm going to do suggestion. I just hiked a mountain. I'm on top of the mountain, and I want to have a celebratory drink.
One cup.
Definitely one cups, yes.
What is one cup?
One cup is the move because they have, so they're like a cup. They're a cup, a glass cup, or sometimes aluminum, but they have a lid, and a lot of them you could put the lid back on. So they're perfect. So you can take it up the mountain in your backpack. When you get to the top, you have a little sip, dink, kanpai, and put the lid back on and just save it for a different time.
I mean, definitely one of my favorite memories of hiking was taking a bunch of them and just sampling with my friend at the top of the hike with Alyeska. It was like Winter's Creek, I believe. Mm-hmm. But we went to the top and just like sampled a bunch of sake.
Oh, the North Face.
Yeah.
Good move.
That
yeah.
is a good move. Well, speaking of flights, you put one together, right, Skylar, for Sake Week. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I did. So the first one we have is going to be at Hearth, and I put together two flights. So the first one is just going to be like very classic Junmai and Junmai Ginjo styles. I want people to experience just the, I wouldn't say basics of sake, but what you typically expect when you do drink a sake or when you're ordering a sake. Then the other flight is going to be more eclectic, if you will. So you're going to get Junmai Ginjos, but they're going to be more flavorful. They're going to have a lot more savory notes to it. I even put a fushutsu on there, too, so you get like full-bodied mouthfeel, and you get more complex flavors, too. All these flights are going to be available at Hearth, and it's going to start tonight. So I'm super excited about it. I'm really glad it's being presented.
I like what you did there, Skylar, because you picked out like one classic, more of a classic flight. And then you have a funky, fun one.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I mean, you obviously have passion for the drink. You're putting on Sake Week, and you know, Skylar, you're a sake coordinator. Like, what makes this drink special to you? Why do you love it?
I love it because it's so clean, and there's no expectation with what you're going to get. And I love having that surprise. It's also just kind of a mysterious section, and it does need more love. And so having the Sake Expo and this whole Sake Week is going to be so much fun to have. And to have everybody else experience this too is going to be really exciting.
Why do I love sake? Sake, how I love thee. No. Yeah, I do. I like that it's just super honest. I like it's an honest product. It's an honest industry. And I'm not saying that others aren't. But this one just is so transparent. When I first had my shop in University Mall in 2006, La Bodega, that sake mentor, Marcus Pakasar, came in. Many people have heard this story now, but he came in, took a look around, and he said, "I think it's really great you have sake here. It really needs to be refrigerated." Which immediately I paused, looked at him like, why? And then I heard all about sake, and I've just been entranced ever since.
All right, I want to thank both my guests, both with La Bodega in Anchorage. Pamela Hatzis is the owner, and Skylar Pei is their sake coordinator. After this short break, we're going to learn how to cook with sake with a longtime Alaska chef. I'm your host, Dave Waldron, and you're listening to Hometown Alaska on Alaska Public Media. Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Dave Waldron, and right now I am with Jacob Davis, who is the owner of Organic Oasis, a restaurant here in Anchorage, and we're currently in that kitchen. Jacob, thanks so much for being with us.
No problem. Glad to be here.
So I was told you are a sake geek. What about this drink is so interesting to you, especially as a chef?
I think that it's one that is fairly new in America as far as it being a growing popular drink. I wasn't a huge fan of it when I first started drinking it, but the further I dove into it, the more interesting it got. And it's some of the best stuff I've ever tasted at this point. So, yeah.
What about it really drew you in? And we have a giant sake bottle just sitting on the counter where we're doing this interview, by the way. So, yeah, what about it?
I think that it's fairly easy to drink. I mean, I was a big IPA fan, a big beer fan. I liked whiskey. And, you know, as you get older, you're looking for some stuff that's a little bit, you just kind of naturally moderate, I think. And sake it's pretty easy on your system. It's pretty easy on your stomach. So, yeah.
So do you typically cook with sake at your restaurant, or is this more like just personal hobby stuff?
I have cooked with sake some. I use it in a lot of my marinades, and I have used it a little bit in baking and a little bit in some stocks.
What have you found the best results doing?
Well, I really like it in a miso marinade that I put on salmon, black cod, or black bass. And it's a miso sake marinade, and it keeps the marinade not too sweet. And it has a really subtle umami flavor. So, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so let's talk about umami. That's something that's, like, at least to me, like sort of still a new thing, you know, like in the last 10, 15 years or whatever. What is umami for our listeners?
It is the flavor that's kind of at the core of like mushrooms. It's, I don't want to say that it's savory, but it kind of makes your mouth water. Cheese is probably one of the best examples of umami, right?
Is it easier to cook with sake or to pair food with it, you find?
Both.
Both are easy?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, sake it's just really easy to pair foods with sake. Sake has two different kind of flavor components. One is that umami, right? And you can brew sake to where it has just a ton of umami, right? And that kind of sake is going to go really well with, like I said before, like cheeses, things like that. And you can also make a sake that will almost take on, like, it'll have really bright lemon flavors, green apple flavors, melon flavors. And in that case, that sake is going to go really well with, you know, some fruitier dishes or things like that. Sake goes really well with spicy dishes. So Latin American dishes go really, really well with sake. It's actually really pretty easy to pair sake.
For our gardeners and our farmers market people out there, what are some of the best Alaska ingredients to use when you're cooking with sake or pairing with?
Oh, I definitely salmon, definitely our seafood. You know, I mean, that's what we're going to do today. We're doing a miso, a baked miso salmon, miso sake marinated salmon. And then we'll have that with carrots that are cooked with some sake, and they're Alaskan carrots, and then some steamed broccoli and sesame seeds.
So sake aside, like what are some of your like signature dishes here at Organic Oasis, and what gets you excited cooking over here?
Well, you know, I just took over the restaurant about 5 months ago, and really it's just in the past month that we've done a lot of work in the kitchen. I inherited this from Steve Plante, or not inherited it, but I bought it from Steve. A big reason was because it aligned, our missions aligned, right? We wanted to make healthy food for people. And so so I have really kind of spent this last 5 months learning his menu. And we're just at a point now where we're starting to work on specials and things like that. Me and one of my chefs, Elizabeth, came up with a barbecued tempeh wrap, which is out of this world good. It has a vegan white sauce. We make the barbecue sauce in-house, and it's organic. And it is, and it's good. And that's kind of how I've seen successful restaurants evolve, is that it's a pretty organic process, and we're going to be coming up with great food. But I imagine that we'll do the salmon dish for a special right around Sake Week. Yeah.
Well, you touched on this a little bit to a degree. I enjoy cooking, so I'm always like on the lookout for good recipes, but I don't see a lot of sake recipes out there. Is cooking with it something that you've seen gaining any popularity?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, there is a whole world of stuff to do with cooking. I've seen sake lees, which is the leftover debris, basically, from making sake. Once you press it, you press sake out, and you're left with this, you know, it's rice and it's yeast and it's full of like amino acids. It's really good for you. And that product is, it's really killer product. They use it to make lotions and skincare stuff, which is really interesting. I've never done that, but I've known people to make bread with it. It's a great cure to put on salmon to almost do like salmon lox. They'll come out like salmon lox, and it's the best lox I've ever had. I've had aged steak using the same lees as well. You can do pickled vegetables with it. And so that's a product, that's a byproduct of making sake that you can do a lot of stuff with. It's cool.
It's a very Alaskan thing, you know, waste nothing, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
So obviously when you cook with an alcohol, you're essentially removing the alcohol part and just getting that flavor of the drink. Is this the best way to enjoy sake if you're a non-drinker?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's, oh shoot, there is a rice drink that is non-alcoholic, and honestly I can't remember the name of it. Yeah.
So you said that you brew sake, so you're not just a casual sake drinker. Like, this is a big hobby for you if you're brewing it at home.
Yeah, actually, I was on my way to starting a sake brewery in Alaska before I bought Organic Oasis.
Oh, no
and
way.
So, and that's definitely still a goal of mine. It's a few years out now, but I'm going to continue to make sake and learn. And when we're ready to do it, we'll do it.
Do you have a name picked out already?
Oh, it was, what was it? It was Alaska Sake Company, or AK Sake Company was the last one. But we'll see where it goes from here. Yeah.
And you'd be the first, right?
I would be the first, yes.
Mm-hmm. All right. Pioneer here. I like it. How did you get into cooking? Like, what's your culinary background?
I loved cooking ever since I was a little kid. I had two parents that cooked a lot, and so I would cook with them. We had a big family, so I'd cook for the family. And then, you know, once I kind of moved out of the house, I was just always in a group of friends where we would cook with each other, you know, and we were interested in food and learning about food and feeding each other. And so that kind of evolved into where I was like, okay, well, I'm gonna cook professionally. And actually started out at the Moose's Tooth, you know, back a couple months after they opened, and worked my way up and through the Tooth. I was the chef of the Beartooth Grill. And then I went over to Hearth and Middleway Cafe, and I ran those restaurants for 12 years. And long story short, about 6-7 months ago, my friend took me to Organic Oasis, and I had been here a few times before, and it just seemed like a really good fit. So, yeah.
And so for our Anchorage listeners, they know, like, your career has, like, gone around about just four blocks.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I actually spent a good stint downtown. I cooked out at Hot Quarter in Eagle River. But those were jobs to actually just kind of work with specific chefs and learn, and they were all part-time jobs and whatnot. But, yeah, for the most part, it's been in this little corner of Anchorage. Yeah.
All right, last question. And it's, like, the most softball ever. What's your favorite thing about cooking?
Oh, feeding people, for sure. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's why I do it.
Simple as that.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, well, let's go eat then.
We're going to do a miso marinade. This is a marinade that I've been doing for Alaskan fish for a long time. And it has a basis of miso paste and usually either a mayonnaise. In this case, we're going to be using a veganaise. And that just kind of helps it, like, hold on to the fish. This recipe has... it has miso paste. It has basically, like, equal parts miso paste and mayonnaise. And then we're going to season that up with coconut aminos, which is one of my favorite ingredients ever. It just helps. One, it has great flavor, and it helps the marinade really kind of be aggressive and get into the meat really fast. So it makes the meat have a lot of flavor. And this is something that is great for all fish, for meats, for everything, as long as you want it to be a little bit sweet. We're going to do sesame oil, and not too much sesame oil. I like to cut my sesame oil with either a light olive oil or an avocado oil. And, you know, I might throw a little bit of honey in there. And then I'm going to mix this up. I'm going to pin bone my fish. I'm going to cut it into fillets, and then I'm going to marinate it for at least 2 hours. But really, it's like 2 to 6 hours. You can let it go overnight, but that would be a long time for this kind of marinade. You can use a blender. We use the Robocoo here, which is kind of an industrial food processor, to mix it up, but a whisk works just fine. Yeah. We're also doing some sake braised carrots, and they're sake that is braised with honey, and again a little bit of sesame oil, and then we braise those, and then we finish them off in a hot oven so they get kind of crispy. We're going to peel these carrots, and we're going to cut them into, like, big matchsticks. So we're peeling it, and we want them to be in kind of a bite-sized pieces, so cut it in half, and it doesn't need to be perfect. I like it to be a little bit irregular so that you'll have some pieces that are, once it's cooked, a little crunchy, and some pieces that are charred and kind of leathery. And then we're just going to have that with some brown rice and some steamed broccoli and some toasted sesame seeds.
Sounds beautiful. Sounds Alaskan. Carrots and salmon.
Yeah, definitely. All good right. Stuff. Okay, well, we're ready to go out to the grill. Okay, so we have our broccoli here, and we're going to steam this up until it's al dente. We're lucky enough to have a steamer here. So this will take about 5 minutes. And this right here is this is brown basmati rice, which is one of my favorite brown rices.
So you're putting the rice in this, like, high-powered steamer.
Yeah, I mean, normally at home you're gonna cook this and it's gonna be hot and ready. But at the restaurant, we pre-cook our rice, and then steaming rice is the best way to reheat it. So, and lastly, we have our salmon. And so this is marinated in a nice miso paste. And we'll throw a little bit of oil down on the pan. And that's just so it doesn't stick. And then we're gonna bake this off in a 425 oven for about 7 minutes to get it to be medium rare.
You mentioned it earlier, but what's in this marinade that you've got the salmon submerged in?
This has miso, it has veganaise, but mayonnaise would work just as well. It has sesame oil. This one has honey, sake, and coconut aminos. Yeah. All right, we'll throw this in the oven and we'll be ready to go in about...
7 minutes in the oven, you say?
7 minutes in the oven. Okay, so these carrots have been cooked with sake and honey, and then we're gonna finish them with sesame seeds, and we're gonna mix them in with that steamed broccoli. So these carrots we cooked covered with foil, so it's a braise, and we cooked them with a little bit of sake and some honey and some oil, and then. So I start them that way, and then the way that I finish them, I let them cool down, and then I will cook them uncovered for about 5 minutes to dry them out and get them a little bit crispy. So we're going to take these carrots and we're going to throw them in the oven, and they'll be done right about when the salmon's done.
So what's the texture you're going for everything, like crispy carrots?
I like the carrots to have like a little bit of a bite left inside of them, so they're a little al dente, and then I like the edges to get really nice and crispy.
So carrots 5 minutes, salmon 7 minutes, broccoli?
Oh, and this probably about 5 minutes as well. Basically this dish, if you put everything in it at the same time, it's going to come out at the same time. I'll get some silverware. Okay.
So the salmon, it kind of looks like it almost has like a mustard on it.
Yeah, it's the consistency is pretty close to that. And a lot of the reason why I use like mayonnaise or something like that is that for a marinade, it just holds on to the meat, you know? So it keeps the flavors connected to the meat.
What kind of sake did you use? Is it this one?
Yeah, this is it says Junmai sake. It is a mass-produced, really accessible sake, both in flavor and also in being able to find it. Yeah, and it's kind of my go-to sake to make sake cocktails, to drink if I'm not looking for something fancy, and to cook with.
All right. Nice.
Yeah.
All right, well, I don't want to let your food get cold. I know that's some kind of sin, so thank you so much for making this.
Absolutely, yeah.
Oh, wow, that's incredible. That's really, really creamy. The miso is awesome. I feel like most Alaskans, they cook so much with salmon, and they can really get into a rut of like cooking it the same way every single week when they, you know, thawing out the salmon every week. What do you do for your favorite salmon stuff?
This is one of them, you know, and I love this. I love this on black cod. That's probably my favorite way to cook with this marinade. I love a good blackened salmon, you know, it's a classic, especially when you're working with some salmon that is, you know, midwinter kind of salmon. If it's fresh, I like salt and pepper, you know, and I started out not liking salmon. I'm from California, and I came up to commercial fish in Bristol Bay, and that first year I didn't like salmon, but I just didn't know.
You know now, clearly.
Yeah.
All right, I'm gonna try these carrots now. It is hard to come up with like the proper words if you're not schooled. You know, like it tastes really good.
Yeah.
And I don't drink a ton of sake, so it's hard for me to just like pull out the notes of it. But I feel like I know it, but I can't explain it. Does that make sense?
It just adds a little bit of depth when you're cooking with it. It's a really subtle flavor once it's been through that cooking process. Mm-hmm. But it does add umami, and it does add a depth of flavor.
There's honey in the salmon. Is there honey in the carrot too?
There is honey in the carrot too, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is that one of those things that just goes well with sake? Just honey?
I just like cooking with honey, yeah.
Personal thing, all right. Well, Jacob Davis is the owner of Organic Oasis and a sake enthusiast and brewer. Jacob, thanks so much for having me here in your kitchen and let me hang out, and thank you for cooking for me.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's been fun.
We'll be back with State of Art. I'm your host, Dave Waldron, and you're listening to Hometown Alaska on Alaska Public Media.
Alaska Public Media, this is State of Art. Welcome to State of Art on Hometown Alaska, your weekly dose of Anchorage arts and culture. I'm Ammon Swenson. Coming up, we'll get a preview of the Anchorage Community Concert Band's spring performance called Going Places. It's on April 1st at 7:30 in the Discovery Theater. We're joined by the band's conductor, Dr. Mark Walbers, to find out more.
So the thrust of this program or this concert is to basically take the listener to different places and time in the country. And so we start out in Michigan with our overture, which was written for a summer band camp in the state. And then we proceed from there. We go back in time, visit some other events, and then we finish the concert in New York City in Manhattan.
So why the kind of different time period aspect?
Well, most of these pieces are expressing events that happen in specific times. So the second work of the program called Trail of Tears is really about trying to take the listener back to the late 19th century and let them experience kind of musically kind of the events of that time. And the same thing with the Sousa Marches. The Sousa Marches are about place and time. And even the last piece of the program, which is the Manhattan Symphony, is very much a time-specific snapshot. It has the composer experiences New York City in 1961. And so these are very kind of time-specific pieces, not necessarily about the present, but different locations at different times.
Yeah. Do you think that maybe that's kind of one of the magical things about music is maybe time travel?
Yes. I mean, I think it's about trying to evoke feelings about past events or even present events. I mean, that's really kind of what all the arts, I think, attempt to do. They try to elucidate and help us as human beings deal with the feelings or emotions that we might have for particular events or circumstances or even things in history. So
yeah, and I mean, you know, there's got to be a lot of different pieces that you could have picked that would illustrate a time and a place. So what about kind of what made you pick these specific ones to illustrate these various times and places?
Well, you know, I'm not sure my thought process kind of worked that way. I mean, I think I had kind of had selected the repertoire or most of the repertoire, and then I kind of stood back and kind of was looking at it like, well, what is this repertoire coalescing around? And the Garfield Marches by Sousa, I've always wanted to do those as a pair. They're rarely ever performed, and this would be a premier performance of these in Alaska, I'm sure. But my sense of humor was, well, let's take people to the inauguration and let them hear Sousa's inauguration march, and then it's a little kind of ghastly humor, I guess. Well, then, you know, he gets assassinated 6 months later, and of course, Sousa writes the funeral processional march for him. I kind of started building things around kind of thinking about, well, if I took somebody to some place in time to experience an event, how else might this play out as I'm choosing repertoire? So, and of course, the Manhattan Symphony had been on my list of things to program. And so I had these kind of couple ideas, and then I started programming around those, looking for pieces that would provide a contrasting emotional and musical material so that there's a lot of variety within the concert.
Yeah, and speaking of some of the contrast, I want to talk about a couple of the pieces. So the first piece is called Wolverine Summer, composed by Randall Standridge. And I really enjoyed checking this one out, just kind of the optimistic vibe, the triumphant kind of nature of it. Can you kind of tell me some of the story behind it?
Well, there's not a whole lot of story behind it other than that it was written for a summer band camp in Wolverine, Michigan. And Randall Standridge is currently a fairly popular composer of kind of public school band repertoire. But I think this is one of his better kind of more substantial pieces. And I too, my reaction to it was that it was just joyous. I love the kind of the interesting rhythms and textures that he puts out there. And I thought it made just a terrific overture. And of course, all of our programs, I try to program things that are contemporary all the way back to kind of classics or repertoire. And so this would be one of the more kind of contemporary pieces on the program.
Yeah. And then contrasting that kind of feel, the next one, there's a mood shift. Less optimistic, perhaps, than the last one. But what's the story behind James Barnes's Trail of Tears? You did kind of mention a little bit about that earlier.
Yeah, the Trail of Tears is, well, that, as a historical event, it's just this kind of gut-wrenching moment in American history that if there's, you know, if there are things to be shameful of, this would be one of them. James Barnes wrote the piece to kind of commemorate the 150th anniversary of this event with the idea of trying to bring attention to it just to kind of help us remember so we don't ever, I guess, make the same mistake again going forward. And it's very powerful. He incorporates some native poem into the music. So there's a little bit of chanting in some places, and it's very evocative. It's not ethnomusic, and so I don't want to give that, you know, the composer is not an ethnomusicologist, and he's not trying to recreate native music as per se. He's trying to evoke a feeling of this event. And I think he does it with a Western palette, I think, quite effectively.
Tell me about this second half of the performance, because it doesn't, it's not like it takes a crazy turn, but it does seem to shift gears a little bit. Could you dive into that a little bit about maybe what makes that second half unique or interesting?
Well, the second half starts off with a gentle piece by Aaron Copland, and arguably one of America's most Prussian composers of the 20th century. And it's a work that he was actually commissioned by Life magazine to compose, and he composed it for piano. And it's kind of a simple piece. And at the time, you know, people were kind of pointing to it like, well, wasn't this great? You know, a major composer wrote this kind of somewhat easy piece that a student pianist could play. But it's Copland, and it's well constructed, and it has some of the Copland sounds to it. And Copland himself later orchestrated it for chamber orchestra. And then later another arranger came along and arranged it for winds. And so I found that, and I didn't know the work, and I've enjoyed playing it, and it's kind of beautiful simplicity. And
like a different vibe than maybe you're used to.
Yeah, it's just got a real kind of gentle quality to it. I tell my band that, you know, these kind of pieces are always the hardest pieces on the program. You know, they're the ones that leave you exposed, right? Mm-hmm. You have to show that you emotionally understand the work. You have to physically be able to capture the intonation and balance and color, because everything's moving at a slower pace, and there's not things that will distract from that. There's no hiding. You know, I tell all my musician friends that, you know, when we do pieces like that, those are our biggest challenges. You know, it may be slow moving notes, but you know, those are the ones that you really got to work the hardest.
You better hit them right.
Yep.
Well, let's see. So, any pieces that maybe prove to be kind of challenging to get ready to go?
Well, technically, the most difficult work of the program is the symphony at the end. I always try to program one large-scale multi-movement work in a program. Mm-hmm. And so this time around, it's called the Manhattan Symphony. It's by a French composer, ironically enough, named Sergei Lansen. And he came to New York in the early 60s, 1961, I think it was, and he came by steamship. So that kind of dates it. So he's just maybe a decade off from when everybody would just get on a jet and fly. And the symphony basically captures his impressions of Manhattan. And so it's about his arrival. The first movement's about his arrival. Then he takes a walk through Central Park, ends up in Harlem, and where does
it's
he
like
go from
Broadway?
Harlem? Broadway, yes, right. I've never been to New York personally. So from Harlem, yeah, he goes to Broadway and then ends up at the Rockefeller Building. And at the time, you know, he talks about it as being the grandest building in the world. And, of course, it wasn't the tallest building in the world at that time, but it was before the World Trade Centers had been built. And so from his mind, It was just really a grand place. And all understanding, you know, the art decoration and architecture of that complex is really quite beautiful. And he captures that. And he does this with a very stately kind of Passacaglia theme or a Chacon type theme. And that's what finishes out the symphony.
So not necessarily like a picture maybe like Gershwin, maybe, where it's kind of evocative of a New York City, but with jazz and stuff. Not quite like that, maybe.
Well, you know, it's kind of what it reminded, you know, my first reaction when I heard the symphony was that kind of reminded me of a reverse American in Paris.
Interesting.
Right? I mean, it isn't Gershwin, and it doesn't sound like Gershwin, but the attitude is kind of like Gershwin.
Interesting.
Here I am in the city, and here's kind of what I'm seeing and how I'm going to musically kind of portray it.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's a stunning work. It's quite beautiful, and it does have some really challenging things in there for the ensemble to conquer.
Nice. Well, anything you're excited to share with the audience, either maybe specific pieces or portions of stuff or, you know, just excited to put on a show?
Well, yeah, there's always I always include a musical or something from movies or things like that. So this time around, we do a musical called The King and I. And
some people may have heard of it.
Some people may have heard of it. Yeah, it's to me, it's just a really wonderful musical. It's just one of those that, you know, when I first saw as a child, I kind of fell in love with. And every time it comes back, it just brings back all those really nice memories and everything. And Yul Brynner, I think that's probably the first thing I ever saw the actor Yul Brynner in, who basically his career kind of centered around playing that in The King and the I, both in Broadway and later for the film version. And so that to me is a nice way to finish a first half of a program. And everybody kind of leaves for intermission with some tunes that, you know, are fresh on their mind. So,
yeah, totally. Well, let's talk about just the band in general. So what's the situation? Are you still actively recruiting people, or if people are interested, how can people get involved? What's the situation with taking part in the band?
Yeah, you know, since the pandemic, we've kind of come back to more normal numbers. So the fall, we had 70 musicians enrolled for the fall, and we have a group of 60 here in the spring. And usually our spring enrollments are a little bit less than fall, but those are still both pretty healthy. They're maybe only 10 down from what they were pre-pandemic. And yes, we're always trying to welcome new members. We're a come one, come all type ensemble. So there's no audition to join. Basically, you just say, I want to play. And you show up and you just kind of say, well, I think I'm good enough to play, you know, this part, and we give you that part, and you go off and have fun. And that's basically it. The only thing that we ask of people if they come join the ensemble is that, well, you show up to rehearsals, right?
Key aspect.
Yeah, that's a key aspect because, you know, we all depend on each other. And, you know, the whole point of rehearsal is to come together and make music together.
That was my conversation with Dr. Mark Wolbers, director of the Anchorage Community Concert Band. Their spring performance, Going Places, will be April 1st at 7:30 in the Discovery Theater. And that's all for State of Art. I'm Ammon Swenson.
And that's our show for today. Special thanks to Pamela Hotzies and Skylar Pei with La Bodega. You can find us on the web at alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Ammon Swenson produces this show. I'm your host, Dave Waldron. Thanks for listening.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.